Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is December 11th, 2024, and this is episode 488. You are listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warner. I am the co-host, Mark Ames. I am in the greater Rochester, Western New York area, and I am on the line with the Warnerd himself, returning and alive, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan, still in Western Canada. How you doing, John?
I'm fine, but first of all, I have to apologize for missing a show. Luckily, it turned out really well. You, Amr, and Cyrus did a fantastic job and made me nervous about my job, but luckily nothing was lost. The reason I was absent, it can now be disclosed, is that I'm old enough to have a social security income, at least in theory, and I was trying to apply for it while we were in New Zealand, basically waiting for my brother-in-law to die of cancer. And I called them and said, I know I have a requirement to present myself at one of your offices in person, but I can't really do that. And can I get some delay? And at the time they said, yes, we'll hold that for you, but you present yourself as soon as you can once you're in the U.S. As it turns out, they could have said, just go to any embassy and present yourself. But nobody told me that. So I got to Canada. We can't go into the U.S. because Catherine overstayed during COVID, and hence she will be denied entry to the U.S. forever and ever. So we're staying in British Columbia. And I drove down from Chilliwack to Bellingham, Washington. And believe me, that's a hard drive. And I also don't know how to control, how to use in-car navigation stuff. So I was sort of guessing, that looks like south, that looks like west. If I eventually go south and west enough from Chilliwack, I'll hit Bellingham, which I did, and then I spent another 2 hours trying to find Alabama Street. Oddly enough, the Social Security office is on Alabama Street, which if it had a vote would certainly deny Social Security to anybody. and I got there at like 10:36, took a number and sat down, and at 10:40 or so, an announcement came over the loudspeaker. We will not be taking any new applicants today. Please return again. So I had to get out of there and make my way back to Chilliwack. And Catherine kindly made an appointment for me on the next day because I was done. I was like, when you don't have navigation and you're trying to find Alabama Street in a foggy city that you don't know, it's pretty much hopeless. I didn't even have a map, stupidly. Wow. Okay. That was my mistake. And so next day we mapped it out. We mapped out the whole route, and Catherine programmed the little navigation computer, and this calm female voice guided me the whole way down to Bellingham, much easier. And they made a copy of my passport, said, okay, you've appeared. But in the meantime, your application has been deleted. So she said, they may want to reinstate it. I don't know who they are, but they may want to reinstate it. You need to call Social Security. So I wasted yesterday calling Social Security, and they said there would be an hour and a half wait, and of course there was, I timed it, there was a 3 hour wait, and finally I got someone who said, yeah, that's deleted, you can't do anything now, just go to an embassy, though, because you can go to any embassy anywhere in the world, and they'll verify your identity, which is, you know, what I wish somebody had told me last time I called. So I guess we can start the whole miserable process again when we get to Rome and the American embassy.
See, folks, this is why we like war stories.
Yeah.
They're so much more cheerful than, I mean, yeah. This is something I think most people can identify with one way or another. More with the healthcare, with dealing with the healthcare bureaucracy. I mean, I think, as I said in a note to you, like, at least, like, this is the shit you deal with the healthcare bureaucracy. You get intentionally run around in circles, and their hope is that you delay long enough. Well, every minute you delay is a dollar in the CEO's pocket, unless he's 6 feet under, in which case it's not a dollar in his pocket anymore. But of course, every denial is like another yacht. But with Social Security, you know, if you can outlast, if you have the stamina, then you get locked in on monthly paychecks, and it's pretty much good from there. So at least there's something for it. Like with healthcare, what you're doing is fighting not to pay more to them than you already pay. It's all about how much, how broke you go, you know, and they try to make you go completely broke, and you spend hours, days, weeks on the phone to try to go only partly broke. And it's...
Yeah, because I told people about my three-hour phone call, and they sort of shrugged, like, what? You think that's a big deal?
I know. It's so funny. So much of the sort of, you know, everything the Soviet Union did wrong had to do with waiting, and how bad Soviet customer service was. Nobody cared about servicing you. And, you know, I guess maybe back then people thought American, I'm thinking like in the 90s or something when this was a big talking point, people still thought American customer service was pretty good. I don't think anybody believes that anymore.
Yeah.
The DMV now is like a shining example of excellent customer service care compared to the private industry. So
yeah. And this is worldwide. I mean, in England, in Britain, the strategy is very simple, but unfortunately it works. Like, you chip away at state care, you put up a scare or a horror story every day in the tabloids, and at the same time you defund them. And nobody wants, and you hope that most people won't make the link between those two things. And they don't, because it's easier to be angry. And, you know, you hope that care can be whittled away until it's so awful that finally they say, okay, we believe the scare stories. Let's have another round of Tory cuts.
Yeah, and they're trying that here. I mean, there has been a stealth, slow privatization of Medicare. Very slow. And, you know, these people, that's the thing about plutocrats. They're in it for the long, you know, they have that, as they say about, like, the Chinese and war or geopolitics. They do have a long view of this, and they're willing to stretch it out decades to win that battle. In the end, they probably will. I was going to, you know, it's funny, last show before, and I want to also say, I agree. Amr did a great job filling in, and Cyrus is always was fantastic. We were lucky to have them filling in. When I found out you couldn't make it, you know, I called up Brendan. I was like, I think that morning, because that morning was when the South Korean president announced that announced martial law and dissolved the parliament and banned meetings and all that stuff. And I said to Brendan, maybe we should do something like that. Like, I'll come on and say, you know, North Korean infiltrators got a hold of John and he's in a safe place. And for now, I'm taking over the show. And Brendan was like, yeah, it's kind of funny, but, you know, let's just do the show. Let's just make sure we do it right. And he was right.
Brandon's all business.
He's all business, I know.
Yeah.
But it was the right thing, because it was a good, serious show. So, Brendan, you still stand by that?
I think it went well.
So, but speaking of South Korea, because we're pros here. I just wanted to bring up some details are coming out about that insane coup plot. And I want to read off. It's so crazy. One thing that's crazy, so it fell apart pretty quickly because people came out in the streets and surrounded him. And this, the president is extremely unpopular. I'd been talking with friend of the show, Tim Shorrock, about South Korea's leader and politics and what was up before the whole North Korean troops in Russia became big. I started seeing, this was when first the South Koreans were pushing it, but NATO and Biden at first were saying, this is kind of bullshit. We don't see any signs of this. And Tim was telling me about, you know, how unpopular the current president is. His ratings are like, I don't know, 15, 20%, Yoon Suk-yeol. I think there are criminal charges against his wife and impeachment proceedings. And he's this crazy right-winger. And what really sank his ratings was that Biden and Blinken, they loved him when he was elected because they saw this is going to be a great way to form another one of these, you know, NATO-izing Finland things to surround China. And they worked with Yoon Suk-yeol to form this new, basically, alliance, yet another alliance, like AUKUS, which was South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. It's like a new separate kind of defense pact. But of course, given South Korea's history, this was super unpopular. And I think this is what really, one of the things that really tanked his ratings. People, a large part of the country was outraged by that. And after that was announced and Biden and Blinken were taking these big victory laps and the number two guy in the Department of State under Blinken announced that they were going to nominate him, the South Korean president, for the Nobel Peace Prize for this. So after that, North Korea did go kind of crazy and say, this is insane. This is extremely, you know, militaristic. And so they started ripping up roads and, you know, getting more hostile, openly hostile back towards the South Koreans. And in any event, this coup was pulled off. He blamed it, of course, on North Koreans. Now, the president and his security people, the same ones who were lying and saying that North Koreans had basically infiltrated and taken over the opposition, so they have to be dissolved. They're also the same ones that first pushed this. Tens of thousands of North Koreans have gone to Russia and are on the battlefield fighting against Ukraine. Now, we still haven't seen a single one of these yet. So they either
really
have,
there hasn't been a single photograph
nothing,
of it. Wow.
Nothing. Yeah, as far as I know, I've asked around. I've even seen pro-Ukraine, pro-NATO people saying this. I've seen reports from Ukrainian soldiers fighting in Kursk saying, we still haven't seen any of this and it's probably bullshit. But this was the reason used by Biden to approve of this, of the most dangerous escalation of all, which is firing ATACMS, long-range ballistic missiles, deep into Russia proper.
Imagine that being done if, say, a country bordering the U.S. was revolting against American seizure of some sort of land. And the idea that the U.S. would tolerate weapons like this being launched against American towns or cities is just absurd.
Yeah.
They'd obliterate the hemisphere.
Yeah, they would. I just want to read off a little bit. There's this an amazing thread from an account, a South Korean account that sort of translates South Korean news about what's coming out now about the coup, because the parliament, the National Assembly in South Korea, is now trying to force out some documentation and, you know, revelations about what the coup plot really was. And here's some things that have come out. So they were going to arrest some of the liberal leaders, including Lee Jae-myung. He's one of the leaders of the opposition party. And so the military was going to dispatch the HID unit. This is a special forces unit, its main task is to assassinate North Korean leaders in case there's a war, and so they're usually at the DMZ. But on December 3rd, they were just outside of Seoul. And they were not dressed, this unit, they weren't in South Korean military uniform. They were given false North Korean uniforms. And then they were supposed to either assassinate the opposition leaders, and then, or if that failed and they didn't do it, then more loyal South Korean soldiers were going to go in and kill the opposition leaders and the HID unit dressed as North Koreans.
Wow.
It's amazing. They were going to kill their own special, you know, special forces.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is, this is why, apparently, because South Korea started flying these drones over Pyongyang, spraying propaganda flyers around. And apparently, this was all part of a plan to provoke North Korea to escalate, to do something that would allow a more plausible declaration of martial law. So there were all these deliberate provocations. And this is at the same time then that they came out and said, the president and the executive branch, the security people behind him, said tens of thousands of North Koreans are entering into Russia, knowing what matters to the Americans, which is
right.
The Ukraine war. And
you
so,
know, but I can't help just thinking of a side note, which is almost too depressing to consider, which is, I remember what happened when they dropped all those leaflets on the Shia and Kurdish regions of Iraq before the invasion, and everybody rose up and was massacred. Like, I really hope nobody fell for those leaflets in Pyongyang, because their fate does not bear thinking about.
No, yeah. I mean, that. I guess you're right. That might have been, one of the goals might have been to have the North Koreans start slaughtering civilians, which would also precipitate a crisis, or that they would do something provocative back, and then they get in sort of an escalatory, you know, spiral from there, which they wanted for cover for a coup. But my question is this, though. So initially, I mean, look, the U.S. military is in extremely deep with the South Korean military. I mean, the U.S. military basically is the boss of the South Korean military. Tim Shork has explained that. You know, the U.S. was at first, Biden administration was at first saying this intelligence on tens of thousands of North Koreans going into Russia, we don't see any of this. And then all of a sudden they changed on a dime and said, oh, yeah. Yeah, we do see this. I guess
oh,
now
you mean
we,
those Russians?
Yeah, those tens of thousands of people that we missed. Yeah,
yeah.
I guess we have to fire long-range missiles into Ukraine now. Gosh, you know. And but it raised a lot of questions. One of them being, they must have known the intelligence was bullshit. So they must have known something funny was going on. They knew about his political problems. You know, our intelligence, like, we're so deeply interwoven. This is a state that, you know, that
they
exists
will more,
because
well, that's
of
the
us.
Thing. Yeah, that, yeah. So that's the thing. I think you're exactly right. This is the mania of the Biden administration, which is kind of like a brain dead 20th century American administration that has been rather foolishly given an extra life.
Reanimated.
You know, as like a head in a glass jar,
yeah.
Like Futurama. But and it has, in the old French adage, learned nothing and forgotten nothing. And they want to play in the big leagues. And they are so eager to have, in their minds, caught Russia in a trap that they will mortgage anything to double down on their bets against Russia. They will mortgage the family house, and they would do it in a second. So it's very plausible, just from what you're saying, that because I haven't followed this as well as I should, been busy with, bureaucratic stuff.
And, the serious stuff, not the kid stuff. Yeah,
it could easily be that, you know, you South Koreans aren't taking this whole Ukraine thing seriously.
Yeah.
And yeah, I know. Why should we care? We don't.
Yeah.
And, well, you got any business you want cleared up domestically? You want a green light on something? Like, you know, clear up your problems? little tit for tat there.
My guess, if I had to guess about this, is that they knew it was bullshit, but they wanted to approve the attackums in order that they knew it was bullshit. They knew that he had something cooked up, maybe not a full on coup, because also people like Biden and that class are very much into, like, I don't know, wins and losses, and losing a democracy to a coup is kind of an L for these people. You don't want to necessarily lose it. So they may have kind of fooled themselves. They may have seen it all, knew it was happening, and thought, well, he's just going to scare him to try to get the impeachment process called off. But that's all fine because he's doing this lie, and this lie allows us to have a plausible excuse for firing attackums. And yeah, that's an escalation. But what we really want, and we've been trying to push the Ukrainians to do, is for them to lower the draft age from 25 to 18. And granted, there aren't a whole lot of Ukrainian 18 to 25-year-old males left in the country. But, you know, if we could just get 50,000 on the battlefield, we could really slow down the Russians before the...
By the way, can I just interpolate a bit about the rhetoric on the draft age in Ukraine? Mm-hmm. Like, there are a lot of species I care about, and... I'm not saying humans aren't first on the list, but there are a lot of species I care about. And there's a lot of rhetoric about endangered species. And what's astonishing about the Ukrainian debate is that it borrows so much about the drafting of Ukrainians from 18 to 25 from the endangered species rhetoric. It's almost the same thing. Like, you know, we're going to run out of, there won't be any future Ukrainians for the world.
Yes.
It's bizarre. And yet that's posed as, well, yeah, but on the other hand, we could give Russia some trouble in a geopolitical sense and feel like Kissinger again.
Yeah.
Like, woo, one last fling in Kissinger land.
Yeah, what's the Ukrainian future compared to American prestige in 2025? And you know, that's worth everything. It's so gruesome. And Ukrainians, Zelensky, they're clearly resisting it because since Biden, and we were right about this actually. We were sort of guessing that the reason that Biden did that bam, 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 1, 2, 3, very quick succession of escalations was to get Ukraine to lower the draft age. And so Biden did his part, and Zelensky and Syrsky and Yermak, they still haven't gone forward with lowering the age. So now the Americans have gone public. Blinken has gone public. Like, there's been a lot of very public pressure on Ukraine right now. It's really gruesome. I listened to a bit of Michael Kaufman recently. I've talked about him before. I mean, you know, yeah, obviously he's pro-Ukraine, pro-NATO. He was very good, especially early in the war. He hasn't been as reliable since then. But it was kind of surprising to hear him talk about this. Like, he's so deeply absorbed, as he became popular in the DC Brussels circuit, absorbed the really kind of gruesome mentality. He was like, yeah, sure. And he's Ukrainian himself. And he's, you know, he's not a total ghoul. He's like, yeah, sure, there aren't a lot of 18 to 25-year-olds, but you only need like 30,000, 40,000. You could easily draft that many, and that number can hold the line. And this is just, on top of being ghoulish, it's also, as they say, magical thinking. The problem isn't just the number, because they're able to draft people. It's the top-down problem. It's the leadership. It's the command. It's the corruption. Like, you can draft these kids, then you're going to have even more social breakdown. You're going to have more desertions. Like, that's not necessarily going to plug the line. The problems are so deep. It's not just numbers of manpower. It is that they can't even use, in most cases, whatever manpower they have. Like, they have the weapons now. They're Russians' artillery and drone and various advantages, they don't really have the same munitions advantages that they did, let's say, 8 months ago before the Americans approved that big package. But the war is going the same.
that's one of the things that I keep asking as, you know, kind of an outsider to this, which is, okay, I mean, NATO is like a drunken gambler, and the Biden administration is the drunkest part of it. And they gambled everything when getting the weapons to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, okay, take my house, whatever. But the manpower thing, they seem to have a lot of deeper taboos about that. I mean, I have seen that the German government or someone in Germany is now talking about getting German troops into Ukraine. But I cannot imagine that would be a very popular move.
I think it's the Greens, of course. Who else but the Greens would love to send people there?
It's odd that, okay, since what this side, the Ukraine side, and it's more its backers, what they have is money. Mm-hmm. In thousands of years of warfare, money buys soldiers. Money could buy soldiers now. There are many people so dismally poor in the Horn of Africa who could take apart an AK-47 in their sleep. I mean, literally could. But I don't see anybody talking about recruiting them. I think that frightens people in some way that might be related to demographic fears, like, yes, you know, we got so few people left anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I would think also that I think definitely a big sort of part of this is political / I don't know, racial. But I think another really big part of it is they can't properly process the people they're able to mobilize. I mean, if you've had 100,000 desertions this year, another thing the Americans are leaning very hard on Zelensky on is to stiffen penalties on desertions. Because the Ukrainians I think they were harder on desertions earlier in the war, but then when there weren't very many.
Right.
And they realize now, like, what are we going to do? Like, start shooting tons of people? I mean, it's so widespread. And the desertions are widespread because command is so poor. The problems just are so deep and come from the top all the way down.
Yeah, I mean,
so what would you do with mercenaries if you can't even have, you know what I'm saying? Like, if the people you're mobilizing, if you've had 100,000 people slip away, how would you be able to integrate 20, 30,000 mercenaries who don't speak the language?
Well, you know, you could do it with Hessians or their modern equivalent, like not speaking the language, not being able to blend in, and nobody from the Horn of Africa is going to be able to blend in. And that would make it very hard for them to disappear.
That's true.
And the other aspect of that is they're so poor that they might make that gamble.
Yeah.
I mean, Ukraine is a poor country, yes, but it's a poor quasi-first world country.
Right.
There's poor and there's poor.
It's a really good question. I mean, it really is. There are a lot of questions about this war. And, you know, yeah, that is a good question. You know, what Kaufman's point was, and I think you even made this point, you know, to defend a trench, to defend a position, you don't need as much training and skill as you do to, you know, take ground. Like, you need to be able to hold a place. And so you just need a bit of training, proper weapons. And, like, you can get away with poor training and poor command. So, yeah, if you could stick 50,000 mercenaries from the global south, paying them, I mean, yeah, why wouldn't you? It's a good question. I would think that ethno-nationalism, which is such a big part of the Ukraine project, both from the kind of liberal NGO set and, of course, the whole Azov set, I'm not sure how they would deal with that politically.
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't want to ship them in there in December, at the very least.
Yeah, no kidding. So obviously the big story is, you know, since our last episode with Amr and Cyrus, is that Assad fell, and Jolani and the HTS rebels took control to the extent that they can or have. And there are now sort of all sorts of various nasty jihadist, Salafist, repurposed Al-Qaeda ISIS groups backed by Turkey or aligned with HTS to one degree or another, fanning out all over the country. Lots of I thought it might take longer, but I don't know how much you followed this, John. It's really gruesome. You can only look at so many of them, but the execution videos are all over Twitter, X, because Musk doesn't, you know, moderate the way. It's more like, imagine all the shit that was posted 10 years ago, 10, 11 years ago when Shammy Witness was a hero in the Bellingcat crowd. It's kind of like that. It's just gruesome.
It's going to be awful. And that's strange. I thought Musk would have made an exception in his obviously corrupt and skewed defense of free speech, but he didn't, huh?
It would cost money. I think the one thing that he does somewhat is police a certain level of anything damaging. If something's really damaging to Israel, their accounts suddenly have problems. That's the deal he's made. Nazis, I've never in all my years I've ever been on Twitter have I ever seen so much open anti-Semitism and pro-Nazism. And I think a lot of it is bots. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if half of them were run out of some IDF headquarters. Like, it's because that's not, you want anti-Semitism if you're Israel. You want it out there all over the place. They love that. So that's not the problem. The problem is showing Israelis stomping on dead Palestinian babies and having a gay old time. That's what you want to try to, if somebody is good at that, that's what you want to try to suppress. These videos, I don't know. Yeah, the memo hasn't come in yet. From what I've read and heard, Jolani is trying to, and it may be true, is trying to rein it in to a certain extent. He's got a pretty small arm. I mean, all these militaries were pretty damn small, all things considered. What do they have, like 30, 40,000?
Yeah, to cover and it was a collection of various militias, which were full of, as we've said many times, not just angry, but defeated jihadis. Mm-hmm. And you do not want them defeated fanatics to have rule over you, because they will make you pay. They will make your families pay. It's going to be pretty awful, I would think, unless this thing is so NATO, CIA, Israel managed that they will be able. I mean, it would take a lot of personnel.
Yes.
You'd have to have a commissar, you know, and they would effectively be commissars saying, you know, no, you can't do that. No, well, you can't film it anyway.
Yeah.
Down to the lowest squad level. And I don't think, no, they can't do that.
I heard on BBC today that Jolani, the new leader that, you know, celebrated as the new democracy leader, is going to be holding public executions this week. Yeah. It sounds very holy grail somehow, doesn't it, Monty Python? Like,
it's very there's a whole strange feeling about that. And yet the New York Times today is featuring an essay by this Syrian English-speaking novelist who it obviously represents, you know, the upper middle class urban elite of Syria, speaking about the new dawn and how can we deal with this new hope. I just remember those little essays being written by Iraqis and Libyans.
Yeah. It's the same fucking story every time.
Yeah.
Jelani announced the cabinet for the new caretaker government or new government, which is his regime that he ruled Idlib with. And as Lise Doucette on BBC said, it's a very grim, you know, it's a dark moment because the cabinet named, they're all Islamists. Like, what did you expect?
Well,
you
know,
they're acting really shocked and surprised. Like, they just won. That's what it's going to be.
And as you've said many times, this is not even necessarily that Jelani is this absolutely committed Islamist, because he has shown a remarkable willingness to purge Islamist elements if his backers want it to be so. What it means is, as you've said, Islamists fight.
Yeah.
And a lot of the lukewarm,
he can rely on them,
middle of the Rangers don't fight.
Yeah.
Hey, that would be a good unit name, middle of the Rangers.
So I think where there is still a lot of fighting among execution videos and stuff, I've seen plenty in Latakia or Latakia. I think Joshua Land is a friend of the show. I heard him call it Latakia. I thought it was Latakia, but Latakia, and he should know because he's married to an Alawite and spent many years in Syria.
Whatever seems intuitive if you're dealing with Arabic is probably wrong. So Latakia sounds good.
So I was sent by Cyrus, sent me this video of Uyghurs from their sort of Al-Qaeda adjacent group, the jihadist group, which was part of the HTS umbrella organization in Latakia, in a mosque, basically announcing, you know, we are not here to harm you. Now, Latakia, of course, is the Alawite, as they say, stronghold.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's all Alawite. There are a lot of Sunnis there. Sunnis who used to be kind of the, I think, the more merchant class in the big cities. And then there are a lot of refugees that came there during the war. So they were in a mosque, in a Sunni mosque, and sort of announcing, your friends are here. And they're all dressed in jihadi gear and armed to the teeth. And then they started announcing their war on China. And it's just like, guys, so you have, you know, these Turkish-backed Al-Qaeda rebels announcing the takeover of from one, you know, targeted country, targeted by America and its sub-imperial power, Israel, and they've taken it over. And now they're announcing their war on the Pentagon's biggest rival, China.
And in it's that like, war, Turkey would be big ally because it has massive Central Asian ambitions, which work very well as a kindling for a U.S.-China war.
Yeah,
that would get up a war very nicely.
Yeah, and Israel, of course, has, I think as many people pointed out, have bombed Syria hundreds of times since
like
the regime
488,
collapsed.
I think I saw.
Yeah, and they've invaded and taken more land on top of the illegally annexed Golan Heights, which was recognized by the Trump administration, the illegal annexation, and then, certified, basically, the illegal annexation by Blinken in public early on after Biden took power.
There's something strange about the U.S. It's like it was a bad enough actor even when it was sentient. And now it's in its dotage. And it has sort of intermittent consciousness, if any. And Israel is very happy about that, it seems like.
Yeah.
Let's go. Everything that's on the books, everything that's in Plan X, let's do it now.
One thing I want to say about the bombing, I saw some people who were very good on, I think, very good on, you know, Israel and Syria and Axis of Resistance and all this stuff, trying to make the point, because you're always having fights with your counterparts on Twitter, whether you admit it or not. The point that now that Israel was bombing the hell out of Syria, but they didn't bomb and invade in this extent when Assad was still in power, shows that Israel was fine with Assad and that they really fear the jihadis. It's like, no, the thing was that the Syrian state was still functioning and they could have it was a lot more dangerous for the Israelis to do that, especially after with the Russian anti-aircraft, air defense systems. Like, the Russians pulled out. The Russians and the Israelis had basically an agreement that was sealed. I don't know if it was in 2015 or earlier. And there were sort of rules of engagement. And that's what kept it in. As soon as the Russians were gone and the Syrian state collapsed and the whole central military authority collapsed. Yeah, they're doing what they could do, because that's classic Israel. It's like, we can do it, therefore we will do it. And so, yeah, and it's being reported over and over. Again, it has to be said, even though gets redundant after a while, but Israel's invasion of this sovereign country, illegally invading, taking territory, bombing, is being framed literally, like in the New York Times and elsewhere, as taking advantage of an opportunity, creating a buffer zone. It's like, can you imagine them saying that about Russia? Russia is taking advantage of an opportunity and creating a buffer zone in Ukraine. Like, yeah. It does get tiresome.
Oh. It does. It's like, I saw someone posting an IDF video that they control Mount Hermon now, and somebody saying, "Woo, best ski vacations ever coming up."
Yes, I saw that too. I know. Right. And just one last thing. And then and John has, we'll talk about the subject which we're dancing around right now, which is revenge killings. What life might be like under Jelani and HTS. It was just 6 months ago. Cyrus talked about this, but I looked into it a little bit more in between the last episode and this one. It was just 6 months ago that, as Cyrus said, there was a kind of Arab Spring in Idlib against HTS and Jelani. There were these large-scale protests against the brutality, against prison torture and disappearances and killings in Idlib. And this was just, at the end of May. And before then, there were more protests, but it really broke out big literally in the spring. I'll just read like one account here. This is from Deutsche Welle. Opponents of Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad seeking refuge in Idlib are now protesting, this is in May, against local Islamist hardliners Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. The group is accused of becoming increasingly dictatorial. People in the Idlib region are taken to the streets again in protests triggered by the death of a prisoner in jail, apparently through torture at the hands of security forces of the Islamist militia Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And then it just goes on to list all the different people who've been killed and the various protests and the jailings. But this is also thought, this sort of Arab Spring in Idlib that Jelani dealt with, is also one of the factors, one of the reasons, big reason why he decided he needed to make a breakout soon, because he was facing serious internal revolt. So that was right around the time he started planning this big HTS breakout, and he, got lucky. The guardian angels in Israel and Turkey, well, Israel took out Hezbollah and made his job easier.
Well, but by now, the editorial board of the New York Times knows the drill by now, how they invented the drill. Yeah. So it's a matter of timing. They can admit and even deplore certain levels of graphic horror, but they have to time the gates. They like those lanes that let you onto a crowded freeway, one car at a time, and then the light goes red again. They will admit this 2 or 3 years from now if it's not too close to any election they care about. Yeah. And they will know that most people don't care about, especially Middle Eastern casualties. Yeah. I mean, in this context, Middle Eastern casualties, well, Arab casualties, let's not lie, because people think of them as, people in the U.S. think of them as Arab casualties, even if they think of themselves as something else rather than simply Arab. They don't mind them. I mean, I had a few boomer, and I speak as a boomer, reactions to an article deploring the horrors of Gaza that it was by an American boomer, and it was like, did you read about what the attackers did in the Olympic takeover in 1972? And it's like, oh, God. Yeah. And it's all about knife work with genitals and all that, which I don't even know if that happened, but it's a classic story that you want people to hold on to forever.
Yeah.
So they don't care.
They don't care, and the closest you could say is they can be convinced to care if the State Department wants you to care, and then the State Department will massage a lot of great stories for the big papers and big media, and then the media will push it on you, and some people, a certain demographic, will pretend to care because they think the right people care.
Well, I think it broke. It broke before the election at about age 45. And
yes.
I think there was a lot of real resistance that infuriated the DNC by people under 45.
Man, I can tell you there's a lot. Speaking of revenge killings, I mean, I've personally anecdotally seen this from otherwise nice liberals that I've gotten to know a little bit out here. After the election, one of them saw me at my fitness club with a book on the Gaza killings and pretended not to notice it, and then basically said, yeah, now that Trump's won, basically without exactly these words, I can't wait for the people who've cared about this to get it, to get what's coming to them from Trump. And wow. I've been seeing this so much, and I kept hearing people saying that they're hearing it from liberals they know, that instead of sort of like shock and fury at Trump and what are we going to do, it's like, I can't wait for the people who were, you know, for Gaza, for the Palestinians, against the genocide.
You know, I'll tell you something
funny. To them.
Yeah, I've heard that. But I'll tell you what's weird about it. I kind of think the Trumpies have a soft spot for actual leftists as opposed to NYT liberals. It's it's weird, but I think that because the actual leftists are grumpy little outliers and
who attack liberals also. You know what it is? Is that in the minds of sort of Trump supporters and that whole ecosystem, a radical leftist communist is Kamala Harris. Hillary Clinton. That's what they think. So when they see actual leftists or whatever, they think they just don't, they don't, they think these people aren't really our problem so much.
Yeah, or they don't exist.
Like, unless it's Portland, unless they're out on the streets of Portland, then. But as a general rule, I think their real hatred, their deep hatred is for liberals, is for establishment liberals. That's kind of true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I realize now we're, 45 minutes or more into, because we haven't been a-chatting for a while. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to just make this a World of Wars episode, and we'll talk about the other, the big topic that we meant to talk about today, which is looking back at post-revolution purges and, what you should do if you're on the wrong side
of that. Can you guess if you're going to be killed or not? I mean, like in the aftermath of a purge like this, a regime change like this.
So let's save that for next episode, and let's finish up the things we wanted to talk about today, because there are a couple more subjects we did want to talk. There's so much going on. I mean, I get all these notes from people like, is it just me, or is there just too much going on? I don't remember anything like this, It just, and the volume does seem to constantly go up more and more. I don't know if it's if it's facts on the ground or social media that amplifies the sense in your brain that everything's on fire. I mean, I think the world is on fire and it feels hotter because of the immediacy of social media. So it's sort of amplifying a real thing. But getting back anyway to what we're talking about, you know, I think we should maybe say a word at this point as well about the axis of resistance and where it's at. The happy news first, and then we'll talk about the not as happy news. The happy news is, like, there was just a big article today in the New York Times about how the Houthis have just totally screwed global shipping. And of course, they kind of leave aside, it's because a genocide is going on. Yeah. And, you know, Amnesty came out and said, and this takes a lot for them to do, that what's going on in Gaza, I mean, they document the living hell out of it because they're Amnesty and they're very cautious about making pronouncements. And they declared it a genocide. And it was like a page 11, you know, 1/16th page story in the New York Times. Mm. And BBC, people pointed out that they waited for like half a day before posting it. They posted it as a small item on the front page and then took it off completely. Wow. And it's just, it's not news. But anyway, that's what the Houthis, that's why they are stopping and firing on shipping. And the U.S. sent billions of dollars of floating boondoggles to stop it. And I mean, just I'll quote this statistic here to show how effective this land-based impoverished militia has been against the U.S. Navy. The cost of shipping a container from Asia to Northern Europe today is up 270% from a year ago. And the cost of shipping a container from China to a West Coast port is up 217%. And other importers have been hit with much larger increases because all of shipping has been screwed by this in any direction. So, you know, that part's working.
Yeah, that's real, like, actuarial table stuff, because in a way it's like the good side of the sinister mathematics that was used in the healthcare industry.
Right.
It's like you aren't likely, I suppose, to be hit with a missile if you send your cargo through there, but it's possible that you will be. And
yeah.
To the extent that it's possible, your rates go way up. Your insurance in particular goes way up.
Yeah, everything takes longer. So that's on the sort of bright side. Like, that part of the axis of resistance is still fully intact. It might get hurt over time. I mean, a lot of things might change. We don't know. And so, you know, we have to talk about Hezbollah, and we have to talk about, with Syria gone, Hezbollah, of course, got beaten down very hard, has lost a lot in this war with Israel. And now they've lost their pipeline to Iran.
Yeah.
And Iran is not in a mood for escalating anything. Iran, I mean, things might be a bit fragile there, you know? And I'm sure they are. I'm not saying there's going to be, you know, another regime change there in the next 12 months. I'm sure that Washington and Tel Aviv are going to try. And there's definitely a lot of discontent there. But the axis of resistance is that there's a lot of really ugly sniping that you see going on now. I mean, I sent you, John, something from this Gaza-based Al Jazeera guy. Yeah, I've seen a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, crowing about, oh, look at Hezbollah. They can't protect you. They can't protect anybody. They can't protect themselves. And that's clearly meant for a Sunni Arab audience that has a weird sort of feeling about supporting Hezbollah in the first place.
Yes.
And wants a rationalization to abandon them. I have to say, the Houthi, unnoticed by most of the world, have endured so well under such incredible pressure that I think they're hard to get at, you know? They're hard to dig out of those mountains. Nobody particularly wants to go in there, especially after the Saudi army's performance. There were some videos of what you might call battles, in the sense of these scared, flabby Saudi guys fleeing their outposts in terror. Nobody wants to go back in there. And the Houthi, and I say this knowing that a lot of the suffering comes upon the Houthi women and children, and it's not like they're progressive people. It's not, you know, are they nice guys in the old Apocalypse Now sense? Maybe not entirely, if you expect them to prepare their kids for college or whatever, but God damn, they have endured.
Yeah.
They have endured a lot. And that makes them really hard to attack.
Yeah, I think, you know, even if the Iranians massively restrict or turn off support for them, they're not going to go away. They might have, their capabilities might shrink somewhat. I don't know. Might not.
Those mountains have been fighting for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
That's been a Shia stronghold for hundreds of years. It was part of a civil war in Yemen, basically the highlands versus versus Aden, the city, and the surroundings. And it's not exactly that the highlands were right and the city was wrong at that time, because back then the highlands were in league with Saudi and the monarchists, and the lowlands were quasi-communist. But the war has gone on for centuries, and they don't particularly like the Saudis or their part of the country. You know, it's more like a backwoods place that thinks of itself as having had a great past and is now outraged that these bumpkins, from the north, from the desert, who have claimed everything.
Yeah. By the way, talking again about Syria, I mean, look, let's not mince words. It is felt and received and looks like a pretty terrible defeat. And it happened fairly rapidly since Israel went all in going after Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been, I mean, they're not totally defeated. They did come out with a deal that does leave them intact, but they are greatly reduced in power. And that allowed HTS, because it's pretty clear now that Hezbollah were the reliable ground troops in that war, you know, and without them, the SAA, which had been hollowed out for all the reasons Cyrus talked about, but without Hezbollah, the Russian Air Force couldn't do anything, basically.
I will say outright, Hezbollah has done so much worse than I ever imagined, and the IDF has done so much better, at least against Hezbollah than I ever would have imagined, that I'd have to revise my whole thinking about the whole deal.
You know, Hezbollah and Iran and that whole structure worked under different rules, under rules that didn't allow for maximalist usage of American and Israeli power. And, you know, you needed that 9/11 event, you know, which may raise questions, in order to unleash the full genocidal, you know, apparatus. I mean, obviously Hezbollah never had Israel and America's weaponry.
I'm just thinking versus 2006.
Yeah, but Israel didn't go all in. Well, they didn't go all in the same way, did they? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, they were in there for a long time, and they took a lot of casualties in land battles. I think they had a long time to analyze what was going on. And I think part of that is ignoring Gaza as a result.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the whole of Israeli intelligence was focused to the north and didn't want to be bothered about Gaza because they didn't feel afraid of it.
No, you're right. And like my mistake would be also because the Israelis have become meatheads in a lot of ways compared to how they were. But just because they were meatheads on October 7th and in the, you know, in the early part of the war or the genocide, it doesn't mean they're always going to be that way and they can't adapt. It was sort of like, you know, their Hasbara got a lot better. It was terrible, their PR at first. It was a joke. Yeah. People were laughing. Well, it's gotten a lot better. They adapted. It's, I mean, in a gruesome way, it's gotten better. And yeah, I mean, assassinating the whole leadership.
I know. American weapons and surveillance capability, I think, was always sort of doled out slightly carefully to the Israelis. Like, they had mostly what they wanted. But
yes.
The Biden administration did something strange. Like, you know, we greenlight everything.
Yep.
And I thought I discerned moments of uncertainty in the IDF's moves early on in Gaza. Like, how about this? We just, you know, took out a school. You got anything to say about that?
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it's like what Cyrus said. They're used to going too far and the Americans reining them back in.
Right.
And the Americans haven't reined them in still to this day. Because at some point, the Americans thought, we can remake the Middle East, and that's what we're seeing. And I hate it. I mean, I fucking hate it. It's terrible. It's terrible for the world and terrible for the region, but it is happening.
It is happening. And also American weapons, if you have an unlimited budget and a small theater of war, are perfect. They're very, very, very good. But it takes an unlimited budget and a small front. And unfortunately, that's exactly what the IDF had.
Yep. And, you know, hurting Hezbollah, putting them in a position where they couldn't act as the ground troops for Assad, for the SA, getting Iran to really back down. And, you know, I know Iran fired those missiles and made a show of it, but, you know, I think Landis was right about that. It's just, it was no contest.
Yeah, there's one big event that I think people aren't remembering sufficiently, the hit on Soleimani.
Yes.
He was, it seems, kind of a genius
at
organizing coalitions within the Axis of Resistance, which is not the most docile, obedient collection of people in the world. I mean, he did it. And when he died, I think something was lost.
I think another thing has to be said, too, though. It was that assassination was also kind of a testing the waters thing. Because we expected Iran, based on the Iran we knew, to come back with something bigger. And again, they did that sort of pyrotechnic show. It was impressive, their ballistic missiles. And I know it injured a lot of Americans. But it wasn't, there was nothing big. And I don't know if that's because they weren't capable or it's because they did not want to get sucked into something bigger because it's too fragile. They feel themselves too fragile. They don't want to get sucked into a big war. And, you know, what their strength is, what Hezbollah's strength is more irregular. And something big and conventional, the Americans, presumably, and the Israelis could stand off and just bomb the shit out of a whole lot of places.
Yeah, and what that means is that, you know, they, I don't even want to say this, but what they could do well is the more irregular, the better. And we're talking about urban stuff, and it would get really horrible. And it's to their credit that they seem not to want to do it, but that's what they could do.
I mean, they're poison pills since they don't have a nukes yet. I would think they'd be trying really hard to get nukes. I don't know. But their poison pill is sort of, if you really try to take us out, we are going to unleash everything on your Gulf, you know, proxies, on all of the desalination plants and the oil terminals and everything. that's the one, I think, gun they have to our heads. And
well, I think they have another, which is Europe. I think they still have people in Europe. And
but they didn't use them.
No, I know. But I don't think that means they don't have them.
I agree. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. No. I think you're right. But I think, again, if the assassination of Soleimani was a extremely high-value target takeout, like it's one of those assassinations like Nasrallah that really does change things. But also B, it's like, okay, now what are they going to do in response, and what does that say about them and their power? Yeah. And they didn't do much in response, you know, and they didn't do much all along. Hezbollah was the only one that really, and they were always very measured. Israel was, 50 to 100 to 1 bombings when Hezbollah was kind of doing a kind of symbolic help for Gaza. But Hezbollah at least really put themselves on the line, and they paid hard for it. They paid very hard for it. But, you know, we have to ask ourselves, or we have to own up to, that this is, we're looking at another sort of 1967 moment here of, it's a cruel world, and it's defeat. It's a defeat of a form of resistance in the way that 67 was a defeat of Arab secular nationalism as a form of resistance. And
we were talking about that, you and I, and we were trying to come up with examples from a more familiar Anglo world. And that, I mean, the Confederacy experienced defeat, but, that's something I'll talk more about a little later. It's like they expected horrible, horrible reprisals. And it's clear from the rhetoric that they knew full well they would get it. I mean, that they deserved them. Mm-hmm. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen. And the only thing I could remember was a Christopher Hill book on England after the Restoration called The Experience of Defeat. And I thought, you spoiled brats. That's your experience of defeat? Like they dug up Cromwell and they hanged his corpse? Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah, you poor guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. That I think is what is driving also a lot of this ugly sniping that's going on. And it's not everybody at all, but you are seeing it. And I think, as you said, John, there are some people who were not necessarily happy that it was only Shia coming to their rescue, you know, or coming to defend them. And okay, they supported it while it happened, but the failure of it made them furious. The failure of the Shia axis of resistance has made some of them sort of furious. But I've seen some on the opposite end too. I've seen sort of Syria kind of pro Assad, which is a big range. It doesn't mean like I love Assad. It means I don't want the other option. Usually, I don't want.
I'm pro-minority and I'm scared.
Or secular and scared, yeah. But I've seen a lot of them saying how angry they were at, you know, this is all because Hamas did this attack without coordinating with us. And then I've seen people go after Syria as a fake axis of resistance regime. And Assad, you know, like, look at what a phony Assad was. And you know, I think it was Cyrus who pointed out Syria was and Assad, they were not meant to be like ideological axis of resistance. They were not going to go to war against Israel. They made themselves useful to the axis of resistance in a more transactional way.
Well, they were a little busy at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like Sam Kinison. Well, I was a little busy at the time. I was fighting death, decay.
That's right. And I thought, I got to go back to my wife. Yeah, I remember that one. So anyway, we're going to talk more about this in the next episode when we talk, I think, about purge, as you said, and how to avoid dying. But I think for the last part of this show, because again, so much has been going on, we want to say a couple words about Luigi Mangione, the healthcare vigilante, the masked healthcare vigilante. So he was, you know, caught a couple of days ago in a McDonald's. Apparently it was a McDonald's employee, which is just classic, so sad and grim. Like, how am I going to please the master here? But John, you had a few things you wanted to say about this.
Assassination is a big topic in America. I mean, because in some ways it's all we've got. Like, there's not going to be a resistance. The political parties are gross. And when assassinations happen, people invest a lot of things in them. And in particular, they invested a lot in Luigi because he was incredibly handsome. The average assassin is not that good to look at because they're generally people whose lives have been messed up rather badly by themselves or whatever. But he was young, incredibly fit, even though he clearly has health problems. And he was dressed in that hooded outfit like something from Assassin's Creed. And he was perfect in a way. And he just sat there in that video and shot and shot, cleared the gun after it jammed, and then fired a couple more of the famous control shots into the blue blazered body of this sort of stocky health insurance creep. And everyone was overjoyed. But then I saw one of those memes of, you know, there's this female office worker who has a pudgy guy come into her cubicle and she calls human resources on him. And then some handsome guy comes in saying the same thing and she's all happy with it. But they were using Luigi versus Thomas Crooks. Thomas Crooks, I had to look up the name because Thomas Crooks took a good shot, really, at Donald Trump, who incredibly, decades after the big assassinations with rifles, especially the JFK assassination, was unprotected from a rifle shot. And I admit, that did weird me out a little bit. It's very, very odd. But he nicked Trump's ear. And there was a famous photo of him, and it explains why the name Thomas Crooks is not and never will be as popular as the name Luigi Mangione, because Thomas Crooks, as I said in this post I did, which made a lot of people mad on Facebook, I know Thomas Crooks. He was in my high school. He was in Pleasant Hill High. He was one of those guys who wasn't especially very tough, wasn't especially smart. In fact, wasn't very smart at all, and just sort of sat in the back of the class and sort of smelled like bologna sandwiches in an uninviting way. You see the photograph of him. He has this blank sort of stare, bad haircut. And
bad skin.
Bad skin and what looks like a hair lip that has been poorly operated on. And he just screams the fact that nobody particularly cared about him ever. Whereas Luigi Mangione, and people are good at picking up on this, Luigi Mangione from one still photograph shows a lifetime of care.
Yeah. There were a lot of people on the left who were sort of disappointed, probably on the right too, were disappointed that his manifesto did not sort of quote from, you know, left theorists or something like that. It was just very direct and straightforward. They saw he was handsome from the sort of wanted photo when he pulled down the mask and he had this very confident upper middle class smile, like a perfect smile, right? And everyone was swooning over him after that. But yeah, and his little, what they call a manifesto, wasn't really a manifesto, you know, a reminder, the U.S. has the number one most expensive healthcare system in the world, yet we rank roughly 42 in life expectancy. I mean, it's kind of life, you know, so, I mean, his experience with his own healthcare problems and whatever else was going on in his mind made him more aware of things maybe he wouldn't have worried about coming from a privileged background, which is like, you know, what Rutger Hauer's character in
Blade Runner. If you want to do Thomas Crooks as Leon, that kind of works too. Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of this, he says, many have illuminated the corruption and greed decades ago, but the problems still simply remain. It's not an issue of awareness at this point, but clearly power games at play. Evidently, I am the first to face it with such brutal honesty. I have to say, I like that line a lot. It's a really good line.
I like it a lot. And yeah. It challenges people to join. And, you know, after you sent me that manifesto of his, I wondered for the millionth time why there aren't more of killings like this. And I looked up the number of guns in the U.S., and there are at least 400 million guns in the U.S.
It's amazing. I know.
Everybody can get a gun. I mean, how many terminal patients are there that have had their care messed with?
Yeah. This is the thing I think, you know, Thomas Crooks being a nerd went after Trump, the presidential candidate, and might have gone after any other presidential candidate like John Hinckley or something.
Right.
Hinckley for a while was tracking
Carter. Or Arthur Bremer.
Arthur Bremer, yeah. But do politicians have the same, like, cachet that they once did? I mean, look what a hero Luigi Mangione is. I know part of it is his good looks and his privileged background. But, like, the big question really is, will there be copycats? Yeah. And my guess would be yes. This is a one-off thing, and, you know, this we'll know in time. It's going to take time, maybe even a few years, before if we know this is going to inspire others to do similar CEO executions. But, like, look, this country is awash in guns. You've had, at the same time, just a massive amount of guns and gun culture since the mid-70s through today, combined with a massive increase in inequality from the late 70s through today. It's a powder keg. And it's just amazing that all these shootings that have gone on, people haven't targeted the plutocrats. And now everyone sees a good-looking guy killed a plutocrat and became a hero and loved everywhere. This is my ticket to, you know, fame and glory. And I wonder if that's going to catch on.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah. We're not saying, by the way, disclaimer, that we are encouraging anybody to do what Luigi Mangione did. We're just saying if it were to happen,
propose a sociological question.
Yes, yes. Just for the record there. Right, so I think at that we can end this episode. Good to have you back, John.
Oh,
and
good
luck
back
on your next phone call with the Social Security offices.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I know. Man, I was in the shit. I was in the in the jungle.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Talk to you again soon.
Bye.
Bye.